Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
The Biden administration is officially on the clock. So today and for a while on this program, where this economy goes from here. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, today the 20th day of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There was poetry in Washington today, some prose as well. And we'll play a little bit of what President Biden had to say during his inaugural address. But mostly, there was a change in tone from 4 years ago to the new challenges facing this economy and how the Biden administration plans to meet them. We've been talking about that since Election Day, and we will talk about it some more, as I said, in the days and weeks to come. But on this day one of his administration, one of the first things on Biden's legislative agenda is immigration, a topic that is political, yes, to be sure, but which is also for us a labor market story. The U.S. Citizenship Act of 2021 is set to be on its way to Congress. Marketplace's Erica Barris starts us off.
This legislation comes after 4 years of restrictive policies, cutbacks on the refugee program, increased scrutiny on high-skilled worker visa applications, a slowdown in naturalizations. Labor economist David Yeager.
This clearly tells the country that the Biden administration intends to head in a different direction.
The plans include paths to citizenship for farm and essential workers, immigrants brought to the U.S. by their parents, and those who came fleeing wars. All immigrants would have to pass background checks and pay taxes. Stuart Anderson is with the National Foundation for American Policy, a think tank.
These individuals would have more bargaining power. It would also help these individuals themselves improve their own ability to educate themselves and invest in their own skills because they know they would be here with certainty.
This bill also plans to bolster border security through technology. It also calls for aid to Central American countries to address the corruption, violence, and poverty that often drive migrants to the U.S. Julia Gillette is an analyst at the Migration Policy Institute. She says all of this may strike lawmakers as ambitious.
Such a big, broad package as this is likely to struggle in Congress.
Leticia Bustamante of UCLA's Labor Center is still hopeful. A DACA recipient, she's lived in the U.S. for 20 years, and so have her undocumented parents. For now, they both work in factories.
They are folks that don't have steady jobs because of their status. They are folks that sort of just have to go wherever the work goes.
Bustamante says this bill would give them and millions of others more stability. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, because capitalism waits for no one, the S&P 500 is up 532% so far in the Biden presidency. That's annualized, of course. Credit for the dad joke to Barry Ritholtz. He's an occasional guest on this program because, A, We're going back to the days when presidents don't talk about the stock market or the Federal Reserve chair or any of that stuff, but also B, because the stock market is not the actual economy. That said, they are related, and traders were optimistic. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers.
Once-in-a-century virus that silently stalks the country. It's taken as many lives in 1 year as America lost in all of World War II. Millions of jobs have been lost. Hundreds of thousands of businesses closed.
Among those businesses, the National Restaurant Association says almost 20% of the restaurants in this economy have closed in the last 10 months. And until this pandemic is over or under control, that number is going to keep on growing. Marketplace's Justin Ho, who has been on the small business beat for us since this pandemic started, talked to three restaurant owners who have had to close up shop to find out from them what happens next.
For 14 years, Carolyn Bolivar and her husband Ezekiel served chicken, collard greens, candied yams, and other soul food, plus homemade ice cream, at their restaurant Z's in downtown Birmingham, Alabama. Then the lockdown started. Revenue dried up, and Bolivar didn't have any luck getting a Paycheck Protection Program loan.
And that's when we decided that, maybe it's time.
In May, she and Ezekiel closed Z's for good. Bolivar says in a lot of ways, it was a relief. She's 72 and her husband's 85.
First thing I did was I got a sign, liquidation, you know, because I had so much stuff, you know, so many tablecloths, so many chairs, and things like that.
There's a lot involved with closing a restaurant.
What don't you have to do to shut down a restaurant?
That's Emmeline Zhao, who closed her Midtown Manhattan restaurant, Little Tong Noodle Shop, in October.
You have to notify the landlord and beg for mercy, and you have to shut down all of the things like waste removal, grease removal, and HR and payroll.
She closed Little Tong because it mostly served office workers on their lunch breaks, a market that evaporated when the pandemic struck. But she stuck with her plan to open another restaurant called Silver Apricot.
It's a sit-down restaurant. It is finer dining.
It was initially going to be the kind of place where diners spent $100 or more each, and it was supposed to open in March. But Zhao delayed the opening until July.
Come July, that wasn't what the world needed.
So she and her team have had to constantly tweak the business model, changing menu options and price points to try to find the sweet spot.
There's no one correct answer for how we handle restaurants through the pandemic. It's really all about iterations and ingenuity and listening to people.
Sometimes that has led restaurant owners to pivot away from running traditional restaurants. In Portland, Oregon, James Beard Award-winning chef Naomi Pomeroy closed her restaurant, Beast. It offered six-course tasting menus for around $150 a person. Diners sat at long communal tables, eating for 2.5 hours.
I don't think people are coming back to sit like this. Like, not now, and who knows even kind of if ever.
Pomeroy used some of her PPP loan to start a new business in the same location, preparing and selling meal boxes. It's called Ripe Cooperative.
It's basically all online. We're teaching people to cook in their own homes, and so we offer videos that kind of go along with each meal box.
Pomeroy says she's been able to bring back almost all of her back-of-house staff to help prepare the food, but she's only brought back one of her servers.
I'd love to be able to bring more of them back, and I just don't know when I'm going to be able to do that.
In Birmingham, Alabama, Carolyn Bolivar and her husband are still preparing food for people, too. Longtime customers kept asking for her husband's specialty, bean pie, a custard-like vanilla-flavored pie made with navy beans. So Bolivar convinced her husband to start making and selling them.
And it was my idea. I said, well, we could pump this up, and that way you'd be busy, and, you know, this will be your legacy, and blah, blah, blah. It made it sound good.
Now Bolivar says they're baking about 50 a week and trying to keep up with demand.
We have something that a lot of people haven't heard of, and it's absolutely delicious.
Bolivar says the next step is figuring out how to ship them across the country. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
I understand that many of my fellow Americans view the future with fear and trepidation. I understand they worry about their jobs. I understand, like my dad, they lay in bed staring at the ceiling, wondering, can I keep my health care? Can I pay my mortgage?
Unemployment insurance is supposed to help with that, but the economic crisis that came along with this pandemic has exposed some of the cracks in our unemployment system, and that, as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports, has prompted talk of an overhaul.
One of the first things the federal government did in March when the pandemic hit was expand unemployment insurance through the CARES Act, both by adding that extra $600 a week onto state benefits and by making more people eligible for benefits, including gig workers and low-wage workers. Catherine Ann Edwards, a labor economist at the Rand Corporation, says that was a telling critique of the current unemployment system, where every state makes its own rules about how much to pay in benefits and who qualifies.
They all really point to a story that these should be federal benefits that every worker in the United States gets so long as they earned a wage.
Making unemployment a federal program would also help reduce some of the huge racial disparities, according to Howard University economics professor William Spriggs. In many states, Black people and women are much more likely to work low-wage or part-time jobs, Spriggs says, that aren't eligible for benefits.
When you say, what is institutional racism? The unemployment insurance system, it is designed, it is institutionally designed to exclude Black people.
Spriggs says reforming the system, which has been around since the 1930s, so that it works more like Social Security, would make the program more equitable.
There would be federal standards as to what's the tax, who's eligible, and what are the benefits.
And in major downturns, many states also run out of money to pay unemployment benefits and end up borrowing from the federal government. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Might I recommend that you start day two of the Biden administration with David Brancaccio and the crew on the Marketplace Morning Report. Everything you need to know to start your economic day. Coming up,
we can find ourselves strangely missing the smell of the office.
It's that sense of familiarity, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 257 points today, 0.8%, 31,188. The NASDAQ gained 260 points, that's 1.9%, finished at 13,457. The S&P 500 up 52, 1.3%. Closed at 38.51. Netflix up more than 16% today on better than expected fourth quarter revenue, which they reported yesterday. The streaming service, which now has more than 200 million subscribers, also got upgrades from Wells Fargo and UBS analysts. Rival Disney improved 0.8%. Morgan Stanley moving over to banking slipped 0.2% despite fourth quarter earnings and revenue that beat expectations. JP Morgan Chase slowed about 1.4%. Gaming stocks were on a winning streak. Penn National Gaming came up 5.5% today. Sports betting firm DraftKings rose 3.6%. Bonds up, yields down 1.07% on the 10-year. You're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace. Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There's a whole slew of executive orders and actions that President Biden's expected to sign in the next couple of days. Everything from reorganizing the federal government's pandemic response to rejoining the Paris Climate Accords to extending eviction and foreclosure moratoriums. Also, orders that target workplace discrimination, particularly against LGBTQ people. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
For the last several years, attorney Shannon Minter has spent much of his time fighting the federal government in court. He represents LGBTQ clients like Nicholas Talbot, who had planned to enlist in the military until the ban on transgender service members.
For him, hopefully, as well as, you know, countless other transgender people who dream of joining the military, that dream is once again a possibility.
Minter expects new battles in the fight against LGBTQ discrimination, but he hopes the federal government will now be more of an ally than an adversary.
It's going to be a different world now.
One executive order builds on a Supreme Court ruling last year to bar LGBTQ discrimination under the Civil Rights Act. Mara Kiesling heads the National Center for Transgender Equality.
It signals that the federal government is going to start enforcing federal civil rights laws to protect us.
She hopes to see Congress enact legislation to strengthen those protections even further. But Sherita Gruberg at the Center for American Progress says there's symbolic power in Biden's executive orders.
Having that really strong message that you are protected, that you are included, that your identity is not going to be a barrier to your achievement in this country is going to mean a lot to the community, both in terms of protecting them from discrimination and then also making folks feel safe and secure and that they have rights and that these rights are going to be protected.
She says the policies of the Trump administration left many feeling vulnerable. In a survey last summer, more than a third of LGBTQ respondents said discrimination had negatively affected their job and financial security. That number was even higher for people of color and transgender respondents. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
For all that this economy has suffered this past year, one very not small part of it has been doing pretty well. Record low interest rates and a pandemic quarantine-driven desire for a change of scenery helped make 2020 quite the year for real estate. Monthly sales of existing homes hit highs not seen since the housing boom of the late aughts, and sales of new homes were 20% higher than a year earlier. And people were shopping for homes in places they might not have before. So, for this next installment of our series, Adventures in Housing, we are following the path of pandemic home buying.
My name is Cynthia Cummins,
and I am a longtime real estate agent with Kindred SF Homes in San Francisco. You hear all these stories about a mass exodus from San Francisco, and I keep looking around to see people with their trucks loaded with belongings like the Beverly Hillbillies or something. But mainly, they're just moving across town, or they're trying to get someplace where they're closer to a park. By contrast with San Francisco, some of the outlying parts of the Bay Area have been pretty hot, in particular the East Bay, you know, Berkeley, Oakland, and also Marin County. But a lot of people are buying second homes right now. A lot of people are trying to go up to Tahoe.
We just had more demand come out of the woodwork than we've ever seen before. My name's Dave Westall. I'm a realtor in Tahoe City, California, and I work for Corcoran Global Living. And for me personally, going into May, my business was down 80% year over year, and I was in freakout mode. And then all of a sudden, restrictions started getting lifted a little bit. By June, we were starting to see above average demand for that time of the year. And then by July, it just got insanely busy. But we're also seeing a migration of people from the Tahoe and Truckee region move to Montana, more remote areas that are kind of up and coming. And they realize that they've created a lot of equity in their homes.
Higher-end markets and tapping into ours, and it's creating a staggering imbalance. My name is Mindy Palmer, and I'm a realtor with Berkshire Hathaway Montana Properties Real Estate in Missoula, Montana. It's been, for lack of a more delicate term, insane. It's the perfect storm of all-time low inventory. Interest rates have been low. You throw in a pandemic and, wildfires and various disasters throughout the country and everybody wanting out and wanting to come here. On the other side of the coin, it's very difficult for the local Missoulian. It's heartbreaking to see somebody that's worked hard all their life to try to save up to buy their first home, and then they come to you and say, all I can afford is $210,000. And the very first words out of our mouths next are, how far are you willing to look outside of Missoula to achieve that? I've made a very good living helping normal people. I'm not saying that the higher end is abnormal, but what I'm saying is real people. So to see that slipping away, it's a little uncomfortable. A little uncomfortable for me, but I'm not going to back down. If I have to go over to another county to help somebody find something, I will.
That was Cynthia Cummins in San Francisco, David Westall in Tahoe City, California, Mindy Palmer. She's in Missoula, Montana. Do us a favor. Would you tell us about your adventure in housing? You can do it at marketplace.org. Okay, now for something completely different. Scientists in Europe are putting together an archive of historic smells, like 400 years old historic, some of them. It could add a new olfactory dimension to museums and heritage sites. It might help us understand the importance of smell in political and economic history. And it might have some more modern commercial applications that are nothing to be sniffed at. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
When it comes to history, smell is the neglected sense. We can see images of the past and touch ancient objects, but we rarely get a whiff of history.
How smells had a role in daily lives, domestic lives, in the economies, in the politics.
Cecilia Bembibre of University College London is one of the scientists working on the Odoropa archive.
Digging out references to past smells and trying to bring them to our noses today.
like the smell of money, for example, in the cradle of capitalism. A gong signals the start of trading in the Euronext exchange in Amsterdam. Its forerunner was reputedly the world's first stock market. Historian Will Tullett says the project will recreate the odours that wafted through in the 17th century.
This had a very distinct smell as a space, which included the river water from the Amstel, which flowed underneath the stock exchange, the sweat and the musk from the traders that crowded on the floor, but also the smells of things like nutmegs and cloves, for example.
The traders shuttled between the exchange and the warehouses that stored the new spices pouring in from Europe's colonies. The traders and merchants of the day, says Tullett, had to have a nose for business.
They're having to distinguish new products and try and understand what a good version of that product smells and tastes and looks like.
The project will use advanced technology to compile the archive, gas chromatography to sniff old artifacts like snuff boxes, and, says computer scientist Marieke van Erp, artificial intelligence to scan literature and even paintings from the distant past.
To recognise that there is a smell depicted or described, and then the computer will put that in a database, and that database will have a connection to, for example, a chemical database.
Which, it's hoped, will turn up a formula enabling chemists to reproduce the odour for use in museums and other places that strive to evoke the past. The Battle of Waterloo has been recreated in countless audiovisual displays. But how much more effective if you get to smell the tumult? Anticipating the Odoropa project, a major Dutch museum has already done this, unleashing in the vicinity of a painting of the battle, as Cecilia Bembibre points out, a curious bouquet.
The smell of the horses, the smell of the gunpowder, the smell of fear and sweat.
And the smell of Napoleon. He apparently saturated himself daily in eau de cologne, says Marieke van Erp.
Napoleon really, really liked this particular perfume, so they decided to put a whiff of that in the smell as well.
Perfume makers have expressed an interest in Odoropa, and so have the so-called scent marketers who sell aromas to hotels and retailers. Cecilia Bembibre says the pandemic has underlined the importance of smell, not least because so many people are now working from home.
And our olfactory environments have been reduced in many cases to our domestic environment. So we can find ourselves strangely missing the smell of the office, for example.
Perhaps because of the more relaxed approach to personal hygiene while working from home. Deodorant sales have plunged during the pandemic. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a very brief look back at the Trump administration, its international economic relationships, to be specific. Just a little bit before President Biden took the oath, the Chinese Foreign Ministry announced personal sanctions against, among others, former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, former Trade Advisor Peter Navarro, and former National Security Advisor John Bolton. They are not going to be allowed into China or be allowed to do business there. Here is your moment of context on this inauguration day. No marketplace angle, just 22-year-old Amanda Gorman sharing some wisdom.
When day comes, we step out of the shade, aflame and unafraid. The new dawn blooms as we free it. For there is always light if only we're brave enough to see it, if only we're brave enough to be it.
Tell you what, she was the best speaker on the podium today, bar none. Check it out. It only takes about 4 or 5 minutes, that poem. Our media production team is Robin Edgar, Garrett Lang, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. They are the ones coming into the studios. The rest of us don't have to, except for your home internet thing. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.